I was waiting for Chairman Berger to get this thing started, but it turns out that I'm the guy, so. Mr. Lampert, go ahead and you've got the floor if you'd kindly introduce your staff, and then let's get started.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Bob Lampert, Director of the Department of Corrections. Here at the table with me is my Deputy Director, Steve Lindley. Behind me in the first row, going from your right to left, is Jeffy Wiggins, who's our Support Service Division Administrator, Carp Carpenter, who's our agency budget person, Dan Shannon, who's our Prison Division Administrator, and Don Sides, who is the Field Services Division Administrator. They're here to bail me out if I get stuck and are prepared to do so. Before we get into the budget itself, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to spend about a half hour overviewing the Department of Corrections, particularly for the newer members. You should all have a handout which has an organizational chart as the cover sheet, and I'll be referring to that during my introductory comments. As the organizational chart shows you, our agency is essentially divided into four parts, the central office functions, and then three divisions. The central office, which shows up as gray on the organizational chart, is comprised of administration, investigations, public information, victim services, policy and planning, and research. Funding for the gray areas of the organizational chart are contained in Division 1000 of the budget. The Central Services Division is administered well by Jeffy Wiggins. It appears in light green on the organizational chart and is made up of fiscal management, purchasing and inventory control, human resources, the Staff Training Academy, information technology, records, the employee assistance and wellness programs, facilities construction and maintenance management, and safety. Funding for the Central Services Division is also contained in Division 1000 of the budget, along with administration. The Field Services Division, which is shown in yellow on the organizational chart, falls under the able guidance of Don Sides. Field Services is responsible for traditional probation and parole and intensive supervision programs throughout the state, as well as agent training, interstate compact for adult offenders, substance abuse assessments under the Addicted Offender Accountability Act, community-based programs including split sentencing and adult community correction center contracts, and community reentry. Field Services falls under Division 2000 of the budget. The Prison Division, which is capably administered by Dan Shannon, is shown as blue on the organizational chart. It's responsible for all audits, adult and vocational education, classification, housing, and case management, substance abuse, sex offender and other treatment programs, contract medical and mental health treatment services, prisoner reentry services, chaplaincy and religious service programs, and Wild Brad prison industries and inmate work programs. Those functions that are shown in the lighter shade of blue on the organizational chart are also funded under Division 1000 along with field services and central office. The prison division is also responsible for all five of our adult institutions, which are shown in the darker shade of blue on the org chart. By the order they appear in the budget, they're Division 3000, the Wyoming Honor Conservation and Boot Camp in Newcastle, which is a minimum custody fence facility that has a primary focus around inmate work programs, including forestry and boot camp operations, and a welding education program and a small industry manufacturing program. Budget Division 4000 is the Wyoming Women's Center in Lusk. It houses most of our female inmates, ranging from maximum to minimum custody. It's where our aquaculture operation and a garment shop are located, along with a 55-bed residential substance abuse treatment unit for females. The Wyoming Honor Farm in Riverton, which is our minimum custody agricultural program, is Budget Division 5000, and it's where our wild horse program and cow and calf operations are located. The Wyoming State Penitentiary in Rawlins, which is our high custody facility, is Budget Division 6000. That's where our main garment factory, wood shop, cleaning supply, and print shop operations are located. And finally, the Wyoming Medium Correctional Institution in Torrington is now our intake facility. It's also our center of excellence for advanced needs inmates, including those female inmates who are pregnant when they come close to delivery, and those male inmates with advanced protection needs, chronic mental health needs, those with the most chronic medical care conditions, those requiring geriatric or hospice care, and those with residential substance abuse treatment needs. It would also house advanced sex offender treatment if that funding is reauthorized. And WMCI is funded under Division 9000 of our budget and is a location for a garment factory and a welding operation. By way of history, at one time we had up to 700 inmates, with the majority of that money going out of state in rental beds. With the opening of the Torrington facility, all of our Wyoming inmates are now being housed in our own facilities, with the exception of inmates who are housed at the 100-bed contracted residential treatment facility in Casper and in adult community correction centers in Gillette, Cheyenne, and Casper. And we'll talk more about those when we get into the budget. Also, we have contracts for a few jails, beds in a few jails in the state to house inmates for reentry or personal safety reasons, but we do not have any inmates in those rental beds at this time. The opening of the Torrington facility has also allowed us to consolidate the highest need inmates into a single facility and permitted us to reduce the duplication of services throughout the agency, which helps us manage costs. Now, if you would, please refer to the second page of your handout. You'll see an overview of our inmate population. The top two tables shows that we currently have capacity to house 2,123 male inmates and 296 female inmates in our own prison beds, with additional beds in the adult community correction centers and 100-bed contract treatment facility in Casper also in use. Looking at the second table first, as of last week, we had 229 females at the Women's Center, four with advanced medical needs who are currently housed at the Women's OBGYN Hospice Unit at the Medium Correctional Institution in Torrington, and nine females currently participating in the Adult Community Corrections Program, three each in Cheyenne, Gillette, and Casper. The reason I wanted to talk about the female population first is that the female population is the fastest growing component of our inmate population, with the majority of the female offenders being confined for nonviolent property and substance abuse related crimes. We anticipate that we will have enough female beds to handle both expected and unexpected population spikes well into the future. I do need to point out, though, that the Women's Center is currently staffed for only 210 inmates. That's under the uniform baseline staffing standards that we use to staff the new institutions and expansions at the other facilities. As you may recall, Mr. Chairman, back in the 2006 session, when we requested positions for the Women's Center, the legislature put some positions on the back burner because the population hadn't grown to capacity yet.
Bob, which when you're looking at your female facility, which is the is it the Lust facility that you say has got 277 but staffed for 210? Is that your point?
That's correct. Well, the capacity is 277. Currently, we have 229, actually 232, I think, this morning, and we're staffed for 210. And I just mentioned that as a heads up, because you can probably expect us to ask for more positions in the next biennium to bring us up to baseline staffing standards if our population continues to grow as projected. And also depending on the decisions about the budget request that we'll be going through in regards to the mother-child program, you may see that as well.
If you were to do that same analysis and you went up to the men's facilities, are there, I mean, you got your current count is lower than normal capacity. Do you have some overstaffing there?
Mr. Chairman, the number of total authorized positions has not gone down with the population, but we're, as I'll discuss in a couple minutes, we're going to be shifting our medium and close custody populations up in that direction in order to bring them closer to capacity and make room for the incoming inmates. Looking at the male population and facilities in the table at the top of the page of your handout, as I mentioned before, excluding the 100-bed contract facility in Casper and our ACC beds in Gillette, Casper, and Cheyenne, we currently have the capacity to house 2,123 male inmates. That includes 312 beds in Newcastle, 283 beds in Riverton, 708 beds in Torrington, and 820 beds in Rawlins. Under ideal circumstances, the capacity at WSP would be reduced to 676 beds to allow for single celling of higher custody inmates as recommended by the American Correctional Association. Normal operating capacities is set at 95% of total bed space, so that's where those numbers come from on the tables. The actual number of male inmates we're housing on our facilities last week was 1,701, with another 98 housed at 100 bed. If we reduce bed space at WSP to 676, we would still have 1,979 beds to house our 1,799 inmates. So on the surface, it would seem that we have a number of beds available. However, we also have another 131 male inmates and 10 female inmates housed in adult community correction centers, and another 15 or so inmates out to court at this time. So if we lost our ACC contracts and our 100-bed contract as a result of budget reductions, we would be at capacity with very little room for growth. As you can see on the right side of the first table, the beds that we do have available to house additional inmates are almost all minimum facility beds. Both WMCI and WSP are near or above normal capacity, which means we have a bottleneck in our medium and close custody populations. We generally can tell what our total population numbers will be 3 to 5 years out. As a regular practice, we run a multivariate regression analysis population projection in order to plan out our future bed needs, which over time has proven to be extremely accurate. While our total population demands today are almost exactly what we predicted back in 2003 using our projection model, the population itself has changed in ways that we couldn't predict. We have fewer inmates qualifying for minimum housing than we projected 8 to 10 years ago when we did our prison planning. We're getting more inmates with harsher sentences, and they're staying longer, which means that they take longer to reach eligibility for minimum housing. Now, we are good stewards of the state's money, so rather than coming in and ask for more beds to compensate and avoid having to add medium beds in the upcoming biennium, we begin to house some inmates at the Honor Camp in Newcastle that we haven't housed there before. Those inmates qualify as minimum custody, but we've artificially kept them restricted to medium housing because of things like detainers and prior escape histories. Now we're carefully screening those people and placing them at the Honor Camp in Newcastle, which has a higher fence. And we've upgraded the perimeter security at that facility as well. So even though we're getting fewer inmates who qualify for minimum custody, we're adapting and will continue to do so in order to avoid having to ask for new beds this coming biennium. Finishing out Attachment A with some information about the inmate population. I'm sorry.
I was just looking at the cost per day down there. You had prison with medical at $128.77. Is there any differentiation in cost between Rawlins and the Newcastle facility? I'm assuming there's some difference in there. I'm wondering if
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, there is a difference. This is the weighted average among our entire inmate population. The larger facilities cost more, and the smaller facilities cost less. However, the cost per inmate per day at both the farm and the camp has risen because of the lower minimum population. So we'll impact that as we move these minimum restricted to the camp and adjust our other populations.
In any regard, are any of those costs lower than the $68.38 on the 100 bed? We're approaching that.
Mr. Chairman, no. Even at full capacity, the farm runs about $70 a day. Correct. Finishing out Attachment A, you can see by offense category that about 49% of our inmate population are serving sentences for nonviolent property and drug-related offenses. So as a state, we may be still locking up some people we're mad at, as well as those we're afraid of. On the other hand, 26% of our male population are incarcerated for violent crimes, and a full one-fourth of our confining population are there for sexual offenses. In case you didn't know it, the inmate population is a needy population when it comes to treatment. As you can see at the bottom of the page, 18.8% of males and 10.8% of females are age 50 or above. And why that's concerning is because an inmate on average is 10 years older physiologically than they are chronologically due to the risky lifestyle that they've led. So someone who's 60 years old presents with the same medical issues as someone who's 70 years old, for example, and elderly inmates are defined as those age 50 or above. We've seen an increasingly higher percentage of inmates age 50 or above, in part because they're aging in place, and in part because we have few older people committing crimes, and an aging inmate population in turn drives medical costs. Two other factors that drive medical expenses are right below that. 26% of males and 66.4% of females are diagnosed with mental illness, requiring medication and or treatment, and as you are aware, psychotropic medications aren't cheap. In addition, 43% of males and 34% of females have chronic medical care needs related to things like hypertension, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, hepatitis, seizure disorders, and cancers. As I mentioned before, 26.6% of our male population are sex offenders. Currently, we have very limited funding to assess and treat this population relative to their sex offending behaviors, and you will see an exception request around this population when we moved into the budget that involves repurposing of existing funds with no increase to the total budget. Moving on and going through the rest of the handout, or through the rest of that page of the handout, 60% of our inmate population has been assessed as being in need of substance abuse treatment, 31.5% are in need of residential substance abuse treatment, and the remaining 28.5% need outpatient or intensive outpatient treatment. We currently have 684 inmates at various stages of their incarceration who need treatment at the residential level, and we have a total of 299 residential substance abuse treatment beds, including 55 beds at the Women's Center, 144 beds at the medium facility in Torrington, and 100 beds under contract in Casper. Given that best practice residential treatment lasts from 9 to 12 months, we have just enough beds at the current time to meet the needs of almost all of our end-of-sentence inmates. That means that we have to prioritize the available treatment beds to ensure the highest-risk inmates are getting treatment just prior to their release, either onto parole or discharge, so we can provide for their aftercare as well. If we were to lose the 100-bed facility as a result of budget reductions, we would not only lose the 100 beds, but we would lose the ability to meet the residential treatment needs of our entire population. As a final note to this page of our handout, much of the population presents with overlapping diagnoses. So someone with a mental illness will likely have a substance abuse and or chronic medical issue as well. So hopefully that gives you some sense of what population factors are driving corrections costs. Before we move through the handout, Mr. Chairman, to some areas, other areas that are driving corrections costs, I was wondering if there's any questions.
Mr. Chairman, Director Lampert, I guess I missed something when you said that the female population was the fastest growing, that substance abuse was one of those contributing to that. What was the other one?
The two types of crimes that are driving the population are property crimes and substance abuse related crimes.
Okay, thank you.
On the percentages that you have, for instance, of like offense categories, I'm assuming that the 26% that those percentages are not mutually exclusive, that some inmates are actually counted in a couple of those?
If they have several offenses, it's possible. But what I tried to do under those particular numbers is split the what I consider the violent offenses are the sex offenses and violent offenses. So that's about 51% of our population is male population is confined for violent offenses, including sex offenses. So I tried to split those out so you'd see that distinction.
So the 17% drugs would not include any of those offenders who had been violent.
Correct. They're under their most severe offense of record.
Okay. Thank you.
You're sort of setting the stage for the Casper facility for that 100 bed facility. I think you're anticipating the question. Well, it looks on its face that we don't need the 100 beds, but you're making the case that for capacity as well as resources, you need that. And my recollection is that we also recognize that they were performing a pretty important function for us when our prisoners were out of state, they did a significant capital expenditure to provide that services, and we have some obligation to help them with the return on their investment. So I guess, if you would, let's just talk sort of candidly about all of the above, and that is, what are they doing for us, what's unique, why do we need them for capacity reasons, what resources they provide that are not otherwise provided, and frankly, if they did make a capital expenditure at a time that we needed to, what's the reasonable time to make sure that they get their return on their investment back?
Mr. Chairman, the original contemplated Senate File 16, is it? Senate File 16 period was for 10 years, as I recall, and we're at the end of that period for the original contemplated length of time. However, we do rely on that facility for both additional prison bed capacity, but just as importantly, or even more importantly, to treat those high-risk offenders that require residential substance abuse treatment, and designed our in-prison treatment capacity to include that number when we did our planning. Without that 100 beds, in effect, we would have people that have high-risk substance abuse needs that would be without residential treatment prior to release, and that burden would fall to the regional substance abuse and mental health centers to provide that instead of the Department of Corrections. If you will recall, there's a budget footnote that requires us to RFP that 100-bed this particular time, and that's in part because it is at the end of the contemplated initial contract period that led to the buildup of those beds, but it's also to ensure that we're getting the best deal that we possibly can. If you'll look at the bottom of the attachment, you'll see that the 100-bed costs us $68.38 a day. It doesn't cost as much as operating a prison and providing treatment in that prison setting, partially because it's a different nature, and partially because, frankly, they get the inmates who would otherwise be housed at our minimum facilities, which are a lower-risk population. So we treat the in-prison, the higher-risk, higher-custody type of individuals, and most of the better-behaving inmates who need residential treatment end up at the 100-bed. So without those beds, we would not be able to provide as the treatment would be prioritized in a way that our high-risk, high-custody inmates would get treatment, and the high-risk for future substance abuse but low-risk for disciplinary inside the institution would go without that treatment.
You might. I'll be right with you. Let me get this. With respect to the Torrington facility, we still have a wing that's not finished out that we could finish out or if we choose to put the money into it?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. We have the capacity to add 144 beds, and the last projection was $9 million. Is that correct? Do that? To complete the shell-out? I'd have to look at the exact number, but I think it was around $9 million to complete.
Now, you'd have your operating costs on top of that staffing. Going back to the 100-day facility, since that's what I sense from your testimony is that with respect to our original commitment that we would keep prisoners with them for 10 years, we've met that obligation. So now it's no longer that the moral obligation essentially is gone. Now it just doesn't work for us, and you're making the case that it's an important part of your programming, that they're providing a good service and you'd like to continue using them. Doesn't sound like you're opposed to the RFP process. You think that's an appropriate way to go?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that we're obligated to go through the RFP. We're at the end of that period of time that we originally agreed to. Frankly, I don't know that there's any other vendors that can provide 100 beds immediately, but we will go through the process to ensure the best possible price.
And just to finish that out, would you explain to us better, you know, where is the facility and what makes it different than the other facilities that we manage in-house?
Well, the 100-bed facility is located as part of the total building at the Adult Community Correction Center in Casper. So there's two parts of that facility. One serves us as an adult community correction center, and the other part serves us as a 100-bed treatment facility. It's a secure residential program. It houses only inmates at the 100-bed. The ACC houses inmates, parolees, and probationers. The ACC side go out into the community to work during the day, and the 100-bed people don't go anywhere. And so it's a secure facility. They get their meals and are housed there 24/7. And so it's similar to what the facility operates at Torrington, for example. But it's very, very specific and limited to just the TC itself. And whereas the inmates at WMCI, for example, have work opportunities elsewhere in the facility and have the opportunity to move throughout the facility, those at the 100-bed are limited to their defined space only.
Now, I guess the question is if you have the beds in-house or the capacity in-house, if you took those resources that you're spending at the 100-bed facility and brought the resources back in-house, could you provide better programming for all of your prisoners by doing it in-house? I mean, would you essentially move more resources in-house, provide better programming? I sense you are defending the need for the 100 beds, but I assume that if you have the fixed cost, if you will, for picking up another 100 residents, then you took the cost that you're using for their daily rate, moved that into the added that to your cost, you could provide better programming, or let's say additional programming. So the question is could you provide better programming for more of your detainees than you can presently if you move that operating cost into the prisons?
Mr. Chairman, the easiest answer to that is we have the capacity, looking at the minimum facilities, to bifurcate, if you will, the treatment facility at WMCI and take some of those beds, up to 100 beds, and locate them at the Honor Farm in Riverton, which would fill that minimum facility to capacity, and provide a treatment, residential treatment program solely for minimum inmates at the Honor Farm using money that we're currently spending at the 100-bed in Casper. Ultimately, that would cost us 100 beds, but we would have the treatment capacity by taking that approach.
That's the question is the if you took that treatment capacity in with those same resources, would you be providing better services to your prisoners than you are now, or would it be the same? And
Mr. Chairman, I can only go on the basis of what our success rates are looking like, and frankly, there's no difference between the success rates of inmates coming out of the 100-bed and those coming out of prison that have completed treatment at our own ITU. So I would have to say that the quality of services provided by the 100-bed is at least equal to what we're providing in-house.
Let me see if I could summarize it. So if I'm asked, you know, why are we putting these folks up in the 100-bed facility in Casper, I guess the easy answer is it's no more expensive than bringing them in-house. We need the resources, and they're doing as good a job as we are doing. Is that a appropriate summary, or is there a better way to articulate that?
Mr. Chairman, on a cost per inmate per day, it's actually cheaper at the 100-bed because they don't have all the additional costs of operating a prison. With that said, that same amount of money applied to existing beds, we would probably be less costly because we wouldn't be paying for the security. We already have that security in place. We already have that staffing in place, so we would just be paying for the additional programming. So we would lose 100 secure beds, but we would have the same capacity to provide treatment.
I just want to make sure I'm understanding. So if I put that in my words, what I'm hearing you say is, look, if we took the cost that were associated with the 100 beds, bring those prisoners back in, we could actually save money, but we'd lose 100-bed capacity and the ability to utilize that those beds are in our system. We have an interest in keeping them in our system, and they seem to be doing a good job.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to ask, I visited that 100-bed facility, and one of the pieces, and I think it was Mr. Lindley was there with me, it was a couple years ago, but it was my understanding, and specifically with the programming, that it was a uniquely different program that had a lot of alumni involvement and a series of different things that over time was reducing levels of recidivism, and that was the reason why it really existed, not just for the 100-bed capacity, but also for the type of programming that was being used and the target of the type of prisoner that they were bringing in. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pedersen, that particular facility is a best practice facility, as is our in-house ITU. They do have some distinction in that they do have an active alumni program that allows people who have completed the program and are continuing to be successful in their own recovery to come back in to occasionally attend graduations, for example, to show the current residents that it is possible to be clean and sober. And those alumni maintain contacts with other people who have completed the program and have a more pro-social attitude than people they normally hang out with. So it encourages that pro-social interaction in a way that's, buoying of their clean and sober lifestyle. So that component is a component that's unique to the 100-bed at this time, and one that we certainly support.
Abandon the support for that institution, what would they use that 100-bed facility for? I mean, is there another existing need for it in Wyoming, or is this pretty much what it was designed for?
Mr. Chairman, I can't answer that, but I would say that in my tours of the facility, there's always the possibility that they could use that to house federal inmates, for example. They would certainly have to seek other contract money in order to operate that facility.
You said that there would, if you took those dollars in and with that population brought them back in, because that's a less expensive population, we have a fixed cost, you could actually save some money. Is that cost savings very significant?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that we determined that we could provide that 100-bed treatment capacity at the Honor Farm. Do you remember the number, 2.3? I think the cost to provide that treatment, just the treatment, would be around $2.3 million for that 100.
We're spending about $2 million a year to keep those resources and to keep them alive.
Correct.
Went to an RFP and the RFP came back at a higher price, then that spread might even be greater. So if after the RFP is issued, they came back and said it was $80 a person, at that point you'd have to revisit your model, I assume.
Correct.
But what I hear you saying, and are these biennial numbers or annual, by the way?
The biennial numbers.
Okay, so so the cost to us of maintaining that resource in its current position is about $1 million a year. Under this present configuration where you have more beds.
No, Mr. Chairman, it would be 2.2.
Mr. Chairman, I think it would be around 2.2 or 2.7 million per year. And I believe the 2.3 figure that the director put out was the treatment cost over a biennium and not the operational room and board and those. So we're currently paying $5.4 million for the biennium for the 100-bed facility. which gives us the capacity of 244 male treatment beds, 144 in Torrington and 100 in Casper, which largely meets the residential treatment needs of the male inmate population.
I just want to turn it over to Senator Peterson in a minute. I just want to make sure I understand so that if we put a dollar figure on it, we're putting about $2.2 to $2.7 million per year to essentially support this operation in Casper. And the benefit then is making sure that we continue that capacity in there, and I also recognize they did a capital improvement in there. That's part of the just becomes part of your inventory of beds.
Mr. Chairman, as you indicated before, if we take the cost of that programming and apply it to existing beds inside the prison, then basically we could reduce the cost of providing that treatment by about half. But we would reduce our capacity for housing of inmates by 100 beds, and we're paying, in effect, $2.7 million for a biennium for those additional 100 beds, which is a good bargain.
I didn't say it right then. You just looked at the programming costs and not the detention as well as the, or
right,
the housing. So if you add all the costs, you're saying it's a wash?
Correct.
Okay. That's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Wright, the medical costs concern me just a bit. And I'd like to know how that compares to other states, the $128.77 per day, if you have that comparison, and how Wyoming compares. I don't know if I understand the liability concerns there of these inmates, and but I guess to ease my concerns a little bit, can you go into detail about the checks and balances that are in place to ensure that frivolous medical treatment isn't being administered by whether the doctors are on staff or contracted, or I guess just go into a little bit more detail and then that comparison of other states, that medical cost for these inmates.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Peterson, that $128 cost is the cost of housing, but it includes the cost of medical services. So it's not just medical services. In comparison to other states, we're at the high end of the continuum as far as our cost per inmate per day. And I'll be going through some of the explanations for that. Part of it is that we don't have the economy of scale that some states have in terms of just the pure numbers. We're also a frontier state, so it costs more to get those services. We are, and I'll explain more about what we're doing to try to control those medical costs here in a minute. But as far as the contract medical costs for states similar to us, we're in the same ballpark as far as the cost of the medical services. We've had some discussion, including, as you may recall, a budget footnote that required us to have a study done of what services we're providing. And we're actually providing probably above a constitutional level of care, but it's kept us out of the courts. And it's provided for a reducing cost of care over time. So although we are at the top end of the continuum in comparison to other states, I think that we're, from all aspects, where we need to be, and we're still working on that, and I'll explain that in a minute.
Yeah, Director Lampert, I'm trying to remember whether I went through that facility or not. I remember going through one up there at one time that was kind of like, I guess it's kind of like trailer houses almost, or modulars, and is this the one we're talking about?
At one time, the 100 bed, it did have some modulars out kind of behind, but that's all moved into the concrete, prefab concrete building now. So what was the treatment set, or ACC housing out in the back, that was kind of a big modular warehouse looking thing, looked like a big mobile home. That's used for some, I think, for some outpatient kind of stuff now. But everything, as far as our capacity, is all inside secure prefab concrete building.
Okay, so it would be, Mr. Chairman, it'd be, if we were to visit today, would it be more or less along the same standards of what we have at our other state institutions, or would it be?
It would be very similar in terms of.
Okay. Right.
They're bigger rooms in terms of more people per room and those kind of things. It's not cells. It's more of a dormitory-style housing, but it's very similar to what you would see at at a secure prison facility.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Director, this your numbers at the bottom of the attachment A. I'm just questioning how you got those numbers because, of course, when you say $68 is the cost per day for that, but then we find that the real cost is anywhere from $2.3 million to $2.7 million. So how do you come up with that about $70 a day?
Mr. Chairman, the cost of the 100-bed is calculated by the size of the contract divided by the size of the population. So the contract amount for a year divided by 100 gives us the cost per inmate per day. So if you, 365 days a year times 100 times divided into the contract amount is where we got the 6838. So actually, the calculation for the 100-bed is probably the easiest, other than split sentencing and ACCs, because we have a contract amount that we can actually refer to and divide by the capacity.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Using those beds, since we're paying on a contract price, do you try to keep it full for the most part?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Okay, Mr. Chairman, if we can move to the third page of the handout, which is labeled Attachment B. As you can see from this first colored line graph, the size of our overall probation and parole populations have trended upward since fiscal year 2004. That's shown by the straight line, red line at the top, which is the trend line. Just in case there's any confusion about the difference between probation and parole, probation is a conditional release into the community under supervision by the sentencing court in lieu of immediate placement into prison or into jail. And about 60% of those we supervise on probation are felony probationers. About 40% of those are misdemeanor probationers. Parole is on the other end of the spectrum from probation. Parole is a conditional release from prison onto community supervision, decision made by the parole board. So it comes after a period of incarceration rather than in lieu of incarceration. So going back to the graph, although both our probation and parole population spiked in fiscal year 2008 and came down in fiscal years 10 and 11, the overall trend is towards growth. The total percentage increase from FY04 to FY12 was 17.8%. So we're serving more and more probationers and parolees than we ever have before. Of course, as you might have noticed, at the bottom of the attachment A in the handout we provided, supervising someone in the community costs a lot less than locking them up. So this additional population costs us less than increases in the prison population. If we move on to attachment C, which is the next.
Before I leave you out, I want to, going back to that second page, and I apologize, I just want to make sure I understand it. When you go back to the 100-bed facility at the 6838, on the medical cost, do we pay that separately, or do they pay that?
Mr. Chairman, if they have in-house very basic level of medical services that a nurse comes in and provides, if somebody has to go off-site, if it's serious enough for that, that's paid separately.
Okay, and then
as part of our medical contract, which we'd be paying for that person if they were in another one of the facilities.
Are there any other programming fees that we have that are in addition to the medical and the 100 bed, or and the, actually it's the 68.38?
I don't believe so, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, we absorb the transport costs and things like that. but the actual cost of housing there is $6,838 plus the cost of medical for off-site or anything they can't deliver. And I didn't include those in the calculation simply because if somebody gets sick to the level that they're going to require routine off-site care, we bring them back to prison.
And you replace them with another?
Correct. So they get low-risk, minimum qualifying type of inmates, and they get low medical cost inmates. So they get the cream of the crop.
Well, when you look at the prison rate, that's is that blended between Rawlins and Torrington?
Mr. Chairman, that's blended across all five institutions.
So if you actually took your Torrington rate alone, what would the Torrington rate be closer to?
Torrington's at $139.81.
So so it's actually a dollar more than that, but that includes medical.
Correct.
So that if you were, it's really hard to compare, isn't it? Because you've got too many factors in there.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The highest costing institution is the penitentiary. Of course, it's the highest custody, so it has the most intensive staffing. And it runs just under $150 a day. And the least costly at this time is actually the Women's Center, and that's because of our reduced populations at our minimums.
You know, I don't know that's going to change our thinking on it, but I think what we probably ought to ask from you is, if you would just do an analysis of those 100 beds, that given that population and their characteristics, what would it cost you if you brought the 100 beds in-house versus what you're paying now, but also give it the same characteristics you are and the fact that you've got certain fixed costs, so you sort of look, this is what it actually cost us, this is what we're paying. And, you know, I don't think I'd... I mean, if there's a differential, fair enough, we ought to just know what it is. And if it's a break-even, that's good, too. But and then we also know that that's based upon the $68, which may change through the RFQ process. So it would be worthwhile at least memorializing what you think the actual costs are. You take those resources in-house, what would it cost you, and so we could see it.
Mr. Chairman, I will say that if we brought those 100 inmates back and put them at the farm, then that would probably return the farm from $128 a day down to probably the $75 a day mark, just because the population has increased and we still have the same fixed costs.
To me, though, that if when you do the analysis for us, I mean, you just do the assumption, okay, if we have the bed capacity and we have our fixed costs, then we're going to change... Some fixed costs are going to change, but mostly it's going to be your overhead costs are going to change. You can quantify that, and you kind of give us a feel for what it would cost to provide for those people in your institutions with the same programming. How much extra would it cost you to do that, and then compare that to what you're actually paying, so that we have a realistic comparison that when our colleagues ask us what's the difference, you know, what is that net cost one way or the other. So,
and I think we need to figure out whether or not you're going to allow the spreading of these extra 100 prisoners across the fixed cost that's already there, or you're going to say if there's an increased marginal fixed cost. And I think you have to say an increased marginal fixed cost, like if you have to hire another administrator or someone else or more guards, those are increased marginal costs. But I don't think you can blend that cost when you figure out what that actual additional cost is. You can't divide that extra 100 by the warden that's there because those costs remain the same. But if you had to hire a deputy warden, then that marginal increase in fixed costs would be borne entirely by the new 100 prisoners. Then you're really comparing apples and apples then, and getting down to what the actual marginal cost is of the extra 100 prisoners in that setting.
Mr. Chairman.
Does that make sense, Mr. Chairman?
If it makes sense to them, I mean, I think whether you call them fixed or variable or whether you call them fixed marginal or fixed variable, ultimately you've got a variable and you've got a fixed cost, and all of which goes into your equation.
Mr. Chairman, I can say that if we brought those 100 people back and we housed them at the facility, at the farm, we would not have to increase any of our staffing. We would have to put in place a new addition to the existing contract that would probably cost that $2.3 million for a biennium. So, in effect, the programming would cost us half as much, but we'd lose 100 beds in the process. But we will do our best to come up with what the Mr. Chairman is asking for.
You know, we all recognize that you want to keep that 100 bed capacity in the state, and it may be more expensive to lose it and bring it back later when you need it. So I don't think we're not oblivious to it, but I do think we need to at least have the analysis done so we can be able to report that we understand it.
We will do that, Mr. Chairman. We were getting ready to move to Attachment C, and this graph shows our total inmate population has increased 18.7% since fiscal year 2004 and continues to trend upward as well. By 2015, we're expecting to have 500 inmates more than we did back in 2004, including those that were housed out of state. So, of course, this increase in the size of the population has also helped drive our corrections budget higher. Unfortunately, absent a change in state policy and practice that results in a lower rate of incarceration in our state, we're expecting to grow to capacity. So again, just as a heads up, you can probably expect a capital construction request to complete that shelled out unit at the Torrington facility in the FY15-16 budget, unless our overall population continues to level off or decline between now and then, as we certainly hope that it will.
A couple questions on that. So 15 to 60 is when you think you're going to need the budget?
Correct.
For completion in during that biennium? Or
correct. And actually to have the capacity by by calendar year 2017.
Well, and I guess here's the real question is then when do you see the need for a new facility?
Mr. Chairman, hopefully we don't. Mr. Chairman, hopefully we don't, unless the overall state population spikes dramatically.
So 15 to 16, that's going to be about a $9 million.
As I recall, Mr. Chairman.
On the Honor Farm, Mr. Lampert, would we have to do any further construction or needs there to meet the capacity?
Madam Chairman, we have a CAPCON request in as a result of our Phase 1, Phase 2 study there for an additional building. As part of that Phase 1, Phase 2 study or the build out of that Phase 1, Phase 2 study, we would enhance the perimeter fence there. Which would address the security concerns that might arise as a result of placing another 100 people there that might not normally be there.
Thank you.
Director Lambert, is there any specific statutes or changes in statutes or sentencing structure that you could point to that has made any significant change in the increase in level of incarcerations?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Meyer, and as we step through these attachments, we'll see some of that growth in sentencing structure, if you will. We've increased our length of sentence about 10 months overall, and we've increased the average length of sentence 10 months overall, and we've increased the length of stay about 3 months overall. Of course, that comes with the premium and kind of helps bottleneck that population. There's just been a trend nationwide as well as in Wyoming to enhance sentences for certain categories of offenses. Most of those are of course, related around sex offenders, offenses and particular sex offenses involving children. We have instituted some new crimes in my tenure here that weren't on the books before, and there's been a trend towards increased sentence length.
Well, I know the question I was going to ask you is, do you have a demand from counties wanting to bring inmates into their facilities for the in the county jail, or is that I know that you don't have the program in there when you do take them in there, but I'm just curious whether you've got them calling for space that, if you had it.
Mr. Chairman, I think we've had pretty good communication with the jails in regards to as we've reduced our budget for those jail bed placements. We've worked with the counties that were, you know, that had built up their capacity, hoping for state inmates to fill them. And we've worked with them to try to dissuade that in the sense that we're abandoning them. At the same time, we just haven't had the need to use those beds to the level that we might otherwise have to have had. The inmates best suited for placement in jails are those that are either so hot in terms of a protection need that we need a temporary place to put them, or the ones that are nearing release and we can use the jail to reunify the family and begin to transition them a little smoother back into the community. So that capacity is still on the books. We're just not spending that money because we don't have to spend that money right now. But the jails seem to understand that. Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned, we're likely one of the few agencies that has no desire to grow. In an ideal world, we would actually put ourselves out of business, and we would be happy to have done so. So I can assure you that growth in the offender population is not due to a lack of effort on our part. We do not want to be one of the Wyoming's growth industries, and we're doing all we can to avoid that distinction. We sincerely believe that we are and should continue to be a Department of Corrections and not a Department of Collections. So, as I mentioned before, and as the next two graphs in Attachment D show you, we're getting inmates with longer and longer sentences, and they're staying longer as well, which is one of the things that's driving our bed space needs and our costs. The average length of sentence, as I mentioned to Senator Myers, has increased 10 months since 1999, and inmates are staying an average of 3 months longer than they did in 1999. That growth came, as you can expect, with an increased cost of confinement and subsequent increases in our budget. Both of those factors, sentence length and length of stay, continue to trend upward as well. Now, staffing has been an issue in the past, as you know, Mr. Chairman, and I wanted to give you an update on where we're at with staffing as well. So the graphs in Attachment E are related to staffing. The first graph in Attachment E is labeled Authorized FTE. This graph clearly shows everybody that the growth in the number of positions in the Department of Corrections since fiscal year 2004, which is when I first got here, the bump in the number of positions in fiscal year 2006 is reflective of completion of the expansions at the existing institutions and the application of uniform baseline staffing standards. And the 2009 jump was a result of preparation for and the opening of the WMCI in Torrington. In FY 2004, we had 800 authorized positions, and in FY 12, we had 1,288. So you can understand some of this growth. Let me remind you what you saw in Attachment C previously. In FY 2004, we had 1,162 inmates and 4,950 probation and parolees, or just over 6,000 offenders in state under our direct supervision. In FY 2012, we had 2,207 inmates and 6,364 probation and parole people in our state, or just under 8,600 offenders under our direct supervision. So our in-state offender capacity grew by 2,600. So I hope you can see that the growth of 488 FTEs is a direct result of increased population and in-state capacity by those 2,600 offenders, which, as a side note, means that salary money previously that was going out of state to pay for contract beds is now being paid in-state to our own employees. So I'd argue that we're getting a better deal for our dollar. The last two graphs around staffing and attachment E show dramatic declines in the number of vacant positions and the rate of attrition in our agency. We've seen a 55% reduction in the number of vacancies and a 13% decline in the attrition rate since 2006. In large part, that's a result of the policy and funding decisions made by those who sat in these chairs before you, so we thank you for that. We do still have people leaving, particularly in the spring of the year, and we are engaged in eternal recruiting, so there's no cost savings to be had there. But we're closing the gap due to our retention efforts and continue to trend downward in those two critical indicators. At the same time, I think it's worthy of mentioning that 40% of our staff are actively engaged in our employee wellness program, which is the highest percentage for larger state agencies, so we're feeling pretty good about our staffing efforts. We do appreciate the efforts of the legislature in moving salaries towards market, but there is some concern, as you will likely hear from some of the facilities' local state representatives this session, about correctional officer salaries. In early 2011, as a result of changes in the state compensation policy, the agency lost its authority to have a pay progression around post-certification levels. And some staff felt that they were promised a pay raise that they haven't been delivered. So not everybody's at the staff level is pleased with the pay tied to market approach and the philosophy that a new correctional officer should be compensated at the same rate as a seasoned staff. But we, as an agency, have no exception request tied to the salaries in our budget, so that discussion, if any, remains for you and will probably take place on the floor. I wanted you to know that any discussion around salaries was not specifically requested by the agency. Is there any questions about that?
We're going to hear. So what you're saying is that there was a compression that took place between senior staff and starting staff as a result of the Hay study?
Correct. The move to 91% of market puts staff at about the same level that they would have received as a advanced certification, post-certification employee. So those that were moving to professional did not get that pay raise that had been previously associated with that step in certification, and those coming in the door are now paid at the same level that they would have been 2 years with an advanced certification.
Younger guys are getting paid better, but there's not as much opportunity for movement up.
Correct.
And when you say moving to professional, what does that mean specifically?
Professional level certification under POST basically requires 5 years of tenure with the agency or with another similar agency. And, of course, there's an advanced skill set that comes with that. But it's 5 years of tenure and additional training.
See, we're seeing this in a couple different, I think this is sort of the same phenomena that the district attorneys came in. They see that with the new, that they were commanding and able to secure younger lawyers at a lower price. And then the savings was really being paid for lawyers that have been around longer. And I guess one would assume is that the younger guys probably don't stay as long because they can see what's happening. The older guys are getting paid more. But so you bring the young guys up. There's compression between the young guys and the old guys. And I guess the question is what's the impact on long-term retention? It may be that if you're getting better younger folks in because the salary is better and you have the retention, then it's probably all neutral. But if you're losing your retention, you have people that otherwise would have stayed longer and they're leaving, then that might create a problem. Talk to us a little bit about what's actually happened.
Mr. Chairman, our data seems to indicate that as a result of our implementation of that post-salary scale that tied salaries to their post-certification level, which was, again, tied to tenure, that seemed to have a fairly significant impact on our attrition rate. Since spring of 2010, when we did away with that ability to have that post-certification level, we have seen a beginning increase in the attrition rate going back up again. I can't tell you that it's absolutely a matter of loss of that salary progression, but certainly that has an impact. We have seen people who normally at that 5 to 8 year level are being, I guess, have enough tenure that they don't want to leave the agency. We have seen some of those staff begin to drift away towards the railroad, other law enforcement, which is unfortunate because we're losing seasoned staff. But again, I can't absolutely say it's a result of that.
Well, so on the retention side, you think folks may be leaving. What about the recruitment side? Is it easier to recruit when you're paying more, or has it changed at all?
Mr. Chairman, the pay progression that we had tied to the certification was actually a big seller when we went to Michigan and elsewhere, and we don't have that ability to tell them, you know, if you're here for 5 years, or, you know, you come to work for us and you go to the academy at this salary level, when you get your basic certification at the completion of the academy and completion of the FTE required to obtain a full basic certification, then you get a pay bump. A year down the road with more training and demonstrate more skills, and you get that advanced post certification, then your pay bumps again. And finally, 3 years later, with additional training, additional tenure, you get an additional bump. That was a big selling point when we went to those states that didn't have that. Now that we don't have that, we just tell them, hey, here's where we start you. And then after that, you know, we're moving people to market, so we can offer you a competitive salary as the state moves you to market.
Well, I guess when you look at it, I mean, is the starting pay significantly increased, or is it moderately increased, but what you really lost was the ability to move people up higher in the pay grade?
I think overall we averaged about $130. Is that close? Increased salary from where we were with basic to advanced, was that about $130? It was either $130 a month or $230 a month. I don't remember which. But between what our entry level was and is now, and that takes the entry level and moves it up to the same pay as the advanced was before, but that eliminates any movement above advanced. So those people would... coming in the door, are paid the same as what we were paying people with 3 years tenure, but those with more than 3 years tenure don't have a pay advance.
Let me ask you about, is the total dollars you've got in your salary pool gone up or down with the hay?
Now the budget is the same, and
it's just the distribution within it.
So it's brought both extremes to the middle. As far as
you know, I think what we'd ask you to do is give us sort of a before and after snapshot, total dollars, and then the breakdown. And then, so you could, if you're really saying, look, for the same total dollars, it was working better before than it is now, then we ought to take a look at this. As much as we have the... Well, let me stop there and ask a question. This phenomenon that you've described, have you taken that to A&I Human Resources and said, hey, look, here's where we were, here's where you put us, and here's our recruitment and retention policy difficulties?
Mr. Chairman, I have had that discussion with both the governor's office and A&I.
And what's the response you get?
And the response from the governor's office is that we should figure out a way to make those people that we promised, or that feel that we promised them more pay, we should figure out a way to make them whole. But with A&I, the discussion has been, you know, we are one among many agencies that would like to do something similar, and that the current approach is towards consistency in pay across all agencies, and focusing that pay around the market level of pay, and that a correctional officer is a correctional officer is a correctional officer, a secretary is a secretary is a secretary.
We were all part of that process. If you would give us sort of an analysis before and after, total dollars spent, the impacts, and if you want to give pros and cons of the both, we'll go to ANI. I mean, at some point, we had certain objectives, but I don't think one of the objectives was to deteriorate your ability to retain people. And it is interesting what you're saying is, look, the recruitment you haven't made my recruitment easier, and my retention is being impaired. Overall, I would say that's a bad thing. So if the Hay study's having an unintended result, we ought to get to the bottom of it. So why don't you put that together? We'll have some more discussion about it.
We will do that, Mr. Chairman. And just so you know, ANI hasn't been totally closed door to it. And we have had some discussions about the feasibility of having two levels of correctional officer. But again, that hasn't come to fruition. So we would certainly be glad to get that information to you. And I will say that from my own personal observation, it was better before in terms of recruitment and retention. But the salary money is still the same.
Well, I mean, that's good to know. And when you provide that information to us and you put your bullets together, making your case of, I mean, do the pros and cons, but if on balance you think it's gotten worse, when you supply that to us, would you supply it to ANI Human Resources so they can see it too, so they know that we've got our attentions on it, and then we'll take a look at it.
We will, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman. The question, Mr. Lampert, that I had for you is in regards to the criteria when you were building on the post-certification with the Hays Group. Was that taken into consideration, those different levels of requirements, in order to become a better officer?
Mr. Chairman, we did have that discussion among all the work groups during the Hays study, but it, again, didn't get any traction.
Okay. And how long do you typically have a worker? One of the employees, is it 5 to 8 years, or so the investment that you put into training the individual in the institution?
Well, where we tend to lose the most is during the first year, and then there's a little bit of a spike again at the three-year mark. But once we get them past that 3 years, or at least during the time that we had a pay promise for 5 years out, they seem to stay that 3 to 5 years, and then for some reason when they get 5 to 8 years in, they just get invested that they have enough invested that they don't want to lose their benefits and pay. But if we can get them and keep them 5 years, then chances are we're going to keep the majority of those after 5 years.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Remembered that when ANI was here that we still have, I think, 565 employees that are below the 91%. So I guess my question, if you could put this in your report, how many of your employees today are still below the 91%? Do you have that number available?
I will have to have them verify, but, Mr. Chairman, as I understood it, we're now bringing – well, no, we're not. I was going to say we're bringing people in at the 91% level, but there were some that we didn't that came in after July, whatever that cutoff date was, that we didn't get to 91%. So we will have some of those, and we'll get that number to you.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. Like all human services agencies, we're at some level a customer service organization, and offenders are some of our customers, along with the public. So attachment F contains three graphs that show positive trend lines along the offender efforts at rehabilitation, showing that inmates are trying harder too. Every offender that we have coming to the system is given a series of evaluations and assessments to determine their criminogenic risk and their needs. Criminogenic risk factors are things that can contribute to criminality, like substance abuse involvement and having criminal associates. And each of those criminogenic categories is assessed during either the initial field contact or at intake. An individualized case plan is then developed around those risks and needs, and we target those dynamic risk factors, those things that can be changed, using evidence-informed programs and practices during incarceration and during supervision. Three of those need areas that have to do with criminal thinking, substance abuse treatment, and education are shown in the graphs provided on Attachment F. And as you can see from these three graphs, the percentage of offenders with assessed needs in each of these areas who successfully completes best practice programming around those needs is continuing to grow. More inmates are interested in and fully engaged in programs designed to lower their risk for future criminality than ever before, and we're providing more and more offenders with the opportunity to become law-abiding citizens, which is an essential part of our mission. I think those successes are best illustrated through the next three graphs in Attachment G on the next page of the handout, which look at offender success rates. These success rates are, in effect, recidivism rates turned upside down, as success is defined as no return to prison within 3 years of release, and recidivism is defined as return to prison for any cause within 3 years of release. So if you look at the first graph, inmate success rate, you'll see that for inmates who are released from prison, we see that 90.3% of them do not come back to prison for a new crime within 3 years of completion of their sentence. Said more traditionally, the recidivism rate for inmates who complete their sentence and subsequently return to prison as a result of a new crime is 9.7% at 3 years post-release. That's a pretty amazing number from a national perspective, where recidivism rates are many times that number. Looking at the second graph, for those who are released from prison on parole and return to prison for either a technical violation or as a result of a new conviction, the success rate is 70.4%. So the recidivism rate for parolees in Wyoming is 29.6%. The majority of those returns are due to technical violations of the conditions of release and not the direct result of a new arrest and new conviction. In an effort to reduce the rate of return for technical violations, we've developed a best practice incentive and sanctioning matrix for those on probation and parole that we refer to as PRISM, and we've worked with the parole board and the courts to implement that PRISM matrix.
Director, on my attachment G, the numbers are different than what you're – maybe we're looking at two different things. I just want to make sure I'm –
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wallace, I'm referring to fiscal year 2008 numbers.
Oh, okay.
Everything is 3 years out.
Okay,
that's
gotcha.
The last cohort that we have that's had 3 years post-release. So I apologize for that.
Mr. Chairman, follow up? Okay, so you're looking at 2008. So the 99.8 in fiscal year 2011 is just an extrapolation?
That's what we've had so far of the population that's released this fiscal year. That's
okay.
How many have returned so far this fiscal year, but it's not 3 years out yet. So we expect that to come back down. I wish it would stay at 99.8%, but maybe we will. We'll have to see. The success rate for those who are supervised in the community on probation as awarded by the court is 58.3%. Steve gave me some figures here that I think is important to note that for probation, misdemeanor probation, the success rate is 53.6%, whereas the success rate for felony probation is 66.2%. So those on a felony conviction are 10% more successful than those that are on a misdemeanor probation as far as recidivism. Again, probation is given to those who have been convicted of a crime in lieu of incarceration or as a conditional release. So you can see that the less costly community supervision works for about every 6 out of 10 felony probationers. And those other 4 are sent to prison as a result of a technical violation or new arrest, and usually it's for a technical violation. Overall, as reported in the 2011 report released by the Pew Center for the States, our total recidivism rate is around 24% compared to a national average of 43%, which gives us the second lowest recidivism rate in the nation. So obviously, in my opinion, we're doing something right. I do, however, want to point out that one of the reasons why recidivism rates may be lower in our state is because we do incarcerate some types of crime or some individuals that other states may not incarcerate. So that means we have a less risky offender population at some level, which can make our recidivism rate look better. So I didn't want to make you think that we're being perfect with all offenders, and that the highest risk offenders are affected to the same level as the lower risk offenders. I know that some of you have occasionally heard me say we should save our prison beds for those we're afraid of and lock up fewer of the ones we're mad at. And that sometimes leads one or two detractors that I have in the state to say that I'm being soft on crime. But I'd argue that we're making smart policy decisions by investing in the kinds of things that make a difference in terms of future criminality and victimization, as well as focusing on front-end, less costly community alternatives to prison, the kind of thing that our existing budget has permitted us to do and the kinds of things that I hope you'll continue to allow us the funding to do in the future. Finally, let's take a look at Attachment H. In the interest of disclosure, I included the first graph for those of you who aren't aware that the Department of Corrections General Fund budget has, in fact, grown over the past 10 years. In FY 03-04, our biennial budget was about $143.5 million. In FY 11-12, it was $273.5 million, which represents a 90% increase over 10 years. An average growth rate of 9% per year in any state agency seems pretty stout to the casual observer at a time when they're having to tighten their own belt. But as you've already heard, many of the factors are driving our costs. As good stewards of the state's dollars, we understand the concern expressed by many of you as well over the growth of state budgets. We certainly contributed to the growth and realize that unchecked growth can't be sustained. That's why you'll see very little in the way of exception results or requests by the agency in the budget request we're about to go through. That's why you won't hear a pitch for more medium beds at Torrington this year, or more staff at the Women's Center, or enhanced salaries for a bunch of one-time expenditures that we might have otherwise included. We figured out operationally and within our existing budget how to deal with those things for now, but we do predict that we can only defer some of those things for so long, and we'll likely be back in the next biennium to address some of those concerns. For now, though, we're focused on doing our part to live within the existing budget. As a final note, before we go into the heart of the budget document and additional discussion around potential budget reductions, I'd like to highlight the final graph in Attachment H. Although we're supervising 2,600 more offenders in the state than we did in FY 2004, although we're operating a new facility and expanded all of our existing facilities, and even though we have 488 more employees in our agency than we did in 2004 and salaries have increased over time, correction spending as a percent of total state expenditures from the general fund in Wyoming has continued to trend dramatically downward, even as correction spending as a percentage of general fund spending has grown nationally. According to data taken from the National Association of State Budget Officers annual expenditure reports, correction spending in Wyoming prior to my arrival in November 2003 was 10.5% of all general fund spending in the state in comparison to the national average of 7%. In FY 2010, according to NASBO's report, which was just released in December this past month, the national average for correction spending as a percent of state general fund expenditures was 7.3%. Here in Wyoming, correction spending accounted for just 3% of general fund expenditures. That's the lowest in the nation. The lowest in the nation. So in summary, before we launch into the budget and begin discussions about how to further reduce correction spending, I wanted you to know that I'm very proud of the agency that I lead, its employees, the work that we do, and the efforts we've made to provide the very best correctional services to the state at a price that many would see not only as necessary but as a worthwhile investment, even though that cost has grown over time. Mr. Chairman, if there's no questions, I'd thank you for the luxury your time have taken, and after a break, we'll get into the budget.
All right, let's get back back to work. Before we leave the charts, Director Lampert, when you look at that last chart that where you've got you show that 3% of our total spending, the our staff says, look, if you're going to say 3% of our you'd have to add in the general fund and the budget reserve account, because most other states probably don't flow through their budget reserve accounts. So it creates an artificially low percentage. If you were 3% of our total $9 billion of spending, you'd have a little bit bigger budget than you do. So what I'd recommend you do, let's do this. Before this week, if you would, just meet with your budget staff, with Brett, and let's redo that chart. You may have to show them the national numbers, but I guess we have a huge, we're saying, look, it just doesn't work that way. Those numbers aren't accurate, and we think you'd have to add in both budget reserve dollars and general fund. I suppose you could back out some capital construction items, but I'm not even sure if you could do that. But let's not pass that around, exhibit around too much until it's been vetted through the scrutiny of your staff and our staff, okay?
Mr. Chairman, we will do that. I do want to point out that this came straight off of the NASBO's website, and all states are I understand that Wyoming sends more money to savings than other states, and that those general funds probably include savings, and that artificially makes this percentage look low. But it's measured. It's been measured the same way by NASBO all along. So as savings has increased, then that could have helped drive the percentage down.
The final number, the 3%, just doesn't work for us. We don't think, which is not accurate. So let's, and if you want to meet with our staff, I think that, frankly, Brett would probably share the same views and Mr. Boswell, but and if you're going to pull off those there are a lot of national statistics out there that you wouldn't like, and you can't just pick the ones you like and the ones you don't like, so. Well, you can, but if they're accurate. But that one, before we tout that as our results, we better make sure that we're all comfortable with the numbers.
Yes, sir.
All right. I think we're now ready to go through the budget.
Mr. Chairman, page 15 of the budget provides a summary and prioritization of our exception requests, which, as you can see, are fairly limited. Division 1000, which begins on page 17, deals with correction operations, which are managed out of the central office. And as a reminder, Division 1000 were those things on our organizational chart that were in either gray, light green, or light blue on our organizational chart. The first actual unit is Unit 1001 on page 19. That unit is for prisons, and we would ask for approval of the standard budget as submitted and recommended by the governor. We would also ask for approval of the standard budget for education. That's reflected on page 22. As well as for the standard budget for the investigations unit on page 26. Unit 1011 is offender management. It's a budget that covers support services offered through Steve's and my offices. And I'd again ask for approval of the standard budget as recommended on page 29. Unit 1012 on page 31 deals with our out-of-facility inmate housing, and we would again ask for approval of the standard budget for that as well. That's for the jail rental beds that we have in place. It also pays for the few inmates that we have housed in federal prisons that we pay for.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lampert, can you tell me again how many inmates we have out of state at this time?
At the current time, the only inmates that we have out of state are either through interstate compact or we have two inmates housed in federal facilities.
Two.
Two.
In federal.
Mm-hmm.
So none in the sense, Mr. Chairman or Madam Chairman, that you, when we used to contract out
right.
for the interstate compact is a common procedure that all states are involved in, moving a few inmates in and out to help each other's state if you have somebody you can't house in your own system, and then you trade, okay. essentially.
Thank you, Steve.
On page 27, where you have the base budget going from in the standard budget, you picked up an employee. Could you...
Through the, I know that, but was it in the last budget? Okay. In the last biennium's budget request for Torrington, we added an investigator for the Torrington facility.
Is that done by budget? By bill or by budget or
through our budget?
G11.
Through our budget. Okay, pages 33 and 34 have the first of our exception requests. It falls under the Training Academy, Unit 1019. It's priority number 8 among our exception requests. By way of explanation, this past year, the military department gave our agency the option of taking over the armory at Rawlins. We've used that facility for training of staff in defensive tactics and also for graduations. And it's also served the community as an emergency response center and emergency shelter. Rather than seeing the facility abandoned and having to search for other space for our training, we elected to accept the deed. Our plan is to shift the pre-service classroom training from the Wayne Martinez training facility on the grounds of WSP to the armory while continuing to use the dormitory space at the Martinez Center for training housing, and we'll then use the large classroom at the Martinez facility to conduct ongoing in-service training for the staff assigned to WSP. This approach maximizes the use of the armory and the use of the Martinez Center and retains the ability of the county to use that facility for emergency response purposes. The reason we put this exception request into the budget was to highlight this change in ownership for the committee. Because it's a new facility that doesn't belong to WSP itself, we felt it was unfair to ask WSP to absorb the utility and maintenance costs of $50,600 per biennium without at least requesting the funding first. However, the governor has recommended denial of this request, so we would request approval of the standard budget for Unit 1019 instead and ask you to concur with the governor's recommendation.
Gentlemen, what's the process? The military department says, hey, look, we're about ready to surrender a facility. The option, I suppose, is to treat it as real estate owned and go out and sell it, or they contact other agencies and you say, yeah, we'd like to have it. Do they sign a warranty deed to you, or what's the process?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the facility itself sits on Department of Corrections land, so it was a little bit unique. They couldn't just go out and sell it. So we had first option, I guess, at the deed. The other option would have been for us to release the property for sale, and because it is an emergency shelter for the community, we felt as good community partners that we couldn't just offer it up for sale. So that's the reason that we took it over, and the warranty deed was transferred to us.
Inside Rawlins or out by the new prison?
It's out. It's inside Rawlins. It's out by where the old prison is, between the old prison and the Bureau of Land Management, and their new building, across from the cemetery.
All right. So it's on your original property where the old prison was. They built a facility, and they say, I guess our choice is to take the building or leave it back or give it back to you.
Correct. Mr. Chairman, Unit 1031 is on page 37. and we would ask you to concur with the governor's recommendation relative to this unit, including the $1.5 million reduction in standard budget necessary to shift funding to the OCIO's budget. Our next three budget exceptions begin on page 38 of the budget. The request for $509,600 included in priority number four request for replacement equipment on page 38 included 400 replacement computers, but it also included 400 replacement monitors. Prior to this time, we have not had a separate replacement schedule for computer monitors, and we had been including them with the request for new computers. Under the new direction, we will be coming out with a new replacement schedule for monitors separate from computers. However, since we have not had one in the past, the original request was for both. It's my understanding that the price of the new computers using the multi-state purchasing agreements is the purchase price for the computers but not the monitors. If that's true, we would still ask the committee's consideration for an additional amount necessary to purchase the monitors along with the computers. So we would ask consideration be given to approving the originally requested amount rather than the $405,200 recommended by the governor. The priority number seven exception request appears at the bottom of page 38. This request for $17,550 to provide for annual hardware maintenance of 30 Cisco switches is recommended for approval by the CIO and the governor, and we would ask for your concurrence. Annual software maintenance costs of our Compass, which is our assessment risk and needs assessment software, is included as priority request number five at the bottom of page 39, going on to page 40. That request is for $124,500, which was recommended by the CIO. The governor's recommendation is for $100,000, which means we would have to absorb the additional cost somewhere else in our budget. And we will, of course, support your decision on this, so we would ask you to support the governor's recommendation.
Dr. Lambert, on this one, on the Compass, what's the cost originally of this program, to put in context your service fee?
Mr. Chairman, I'd have to find out for you. I don't know what the original cost is. It's one of two primary assessment tools used nationwide worldwide for assessment of correction personnel.
And they're both proprietary, Mr. Chairman. We've had this a number of years. I want to say initially, and we've expanded it throughout the system, it started in just probation and parole, maybe like 50,000 or something, 50,000 maybe.
Sort
but
out
it's,
whether the
is it's this probably
a new license fee? Is this going to be ongoing?
Quadrupled. As the director said, there are only two really recognized good instruments, and they're both proprietary. That's kind of where it sits. But
and of course, they they tell us what the software increases in the software are going to be. And as Steve indicated, we've expanded the use of this software considerably to different assessment levels beyond what we originally started with probation and parole, and it measures all those criminogenic risk factors I mentioned in the introduction in terms of what is the risk and what is the need, and drives our case management as well as our planning of our programs.
You check. I mean, it looks to me like you're really paying more of a license fee than a purchase agreement. So do you check the competitors, see what they're charging, and I guess the other, do you ever make an inquiry of what it would cost to just build out your own system?
Mr. Chairman, we, at the outset, of course, went through an RFP process and looked at all of that. Once so much time has gone by and extensive training in the two systems, though they're pretty similar, to back up would be more problematic, I think, than the money that we're talking about in training costs. this company has been, I think, responsive to us and works with us on research and a number of things. So I think that relationship has been decent. As far as building your own, given what we went through with our inmate database, that would be even far more costly than buying a program,
Chairman,
in my opinion.
Last question before I just noticed also the CIO, well, it says CIO recommend approval. When you go to the CIO, you say, hey, look, this is what we're doing. This is what kind of an inquiry does he look at to see whether or not it's an appropriate expenditure for what you have? I mean, whether it's a complicated program, non-complicated.
Mr. Chairman, maybe Jeffy Wiggins can add to this. Our information technology manager, who oversees all of that, has those conversations with the CIO's office. He's very versed in all of our databases and the respective licenses and is familiar, I think, with that kind of overall situation. So I don't know specifically then what conversations he has with the CIO, but he's educated on it enough to be able to have knowledgeable ones, and that's then communicated. I don't know if there's anything different than that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Lampert, I noticed that he said usually the governor will mention that and the other funds will be absorbed within your account or something, so there's no comment there. Is the $124.5 just, you know, this is the sale price, this is what the vendor has said to you? Or the other thing is the chief information officer generally, they cut it back because he can buy it cheaper than this, but this, of course, is a proprietary piece of software. So my question to you is, do you have to absorb it somewhere, or is there some wiggle room there?
Mr. Chairman, the $124.5 is the negotiated best price that we could get from them, and that's what our request is based on. So we would have to absorb the $24.5. Mr. Chairman, Unit 1032, which is our victim services funding, is on page 43. It includes a recommendation from the governor to approve the standard budget, and we would ask for your concurrence on that. We also concur with the recommendation for approval of the standard budget for Unit 1033, health services, on page 45. However, I wanted to give the committee an update around the contract and costs of health care, since total health care cost has been a topic of interest to the committee in the past and was also already today, and it is a large portion of our overall budget. As the chair may remember, Unit 1033 used to include all funding for inmate medical care, mental health, and dental services in a single unit. At the request of this committee, we moved the bulk of the funding for those services out to the various institutions where the services are actually delivered under new unit numbers for each of those divisions. And while that provides some ease of oversight of medical spending by each institution for the committee, it's actually made management of funding a bit more difficult. Not every inmate costs the same in terms of health care coverage, and it costs more, although it costs more to cover medical care at the Torrington unit, which is larger and has a more chronic population than it does at the Honor Camp, for example, we never know where the next heart attack is going to occur. So an inmate assigned to an institution with a low level of medical funding could end up being the one that costs the most, and we have to be leveling that money around in order to cover that cost of care. So it just is a little bit more problematic for us, but it does allow for easier tracking.
Let's talk about that. It was moved out at our request, or did you ask and we confirmed? I don't remember right now.
Mr. Chairman, my recollection was that at your suggestion that we moved that money to the various institutions where the services were delivered, and so we did that because the chairman asked us to. Mr. Chairman, as I recall the discussion, it was just that it would be easier for the committee to see where the expenditures were if it was at the individual institutions where the inmates were.
By institution. I wonder if we can what if we can have our cake and eat it. Maybe we can somehow consolidate them back, but then reflect it by institution in one budget.
Mr. Chairman, we have that ability to to track it and break it out by actual expenditure at the institutional level, even if we have a centralized account. So certainly we will do what the committee instructs.
Let me ask. I got two folks here. Bill, do you remember anything about it more than that? Jeb, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director, I was looking through your 900 series handout, and I see this number, about 28.9 million. Is that for a year, or is that on the? Is that for just this year, or what is the total amount? I guess.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stewart, that's for 18 months under the contract.
Will you provide us with the yearly and biennial amount, or do you have that at your fingertips today?
The total, that's contract amount, 42. For 24 months, the total contract amount for, and that provides 100% risk, all services, is $42 million. That includes off-site at this time, but as I'll explain in a minute, the contract amount will come down, but we will be absorbing some of the risk of off-site costs.
And, Mr. Chairman, that's for the biennium?
Correct.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Director Lampert, when you start going through these budgets, where do we see the pharmaceuticals? Was that 235 medical and lab supplies?
They're absorbed in each of the medical units at each of the institutions at this time as part of the medical costs. It's not separated out. So we have a contract with a vendor who provides all dental, mental, and medical care along with all costs of off-site services and all costs of pharmacy.
Mr. Chairman, do you have anything that separates that out at all?
We have their reports back to us in regards to what percentage they spend on what. And we could certainly provide that to the committee.
Thank you.
Well, I'll accept responsibility for any decision, bad and good. But I wonder if, my first reaction is that we need to see a consolidated medical expense so we can see what's generally happened to all of our costs. And we also want it broken down by groups so we can see where our expensive groups are and not, including the placements that are out of the state institution. So is there a reason why, now I'm going back really to Brett and to Bill, what if we created a new series like an 8,000 series or whatever and called it medical expenses and then had a unit underneath for each different institution, so we have that would pull all the medical costs into one area, but then still have it broken down by unit number within that series.
Mr. Chairman, while they're discussing it, if I could, I think we could do the same thing, keeping or consolidating the spending under unit 1033. And provide for you a cost breakout within that unit without having to create a new division.
If you did it under 1033, then you wouldn't have an A, B, and C. You'd have to break it down by a series with underneath that, so you wouldn't have it.
Well, what I was referring to, Mr. Chairman, was that we could provide regular reports to the committee. That we track anyway in regards to what the expenditures are at each institution for each inmate and provide a summary of that information without creating something new.
Well, I guess my thought was to have the budget prepared so that if somebody forgets to ask you for it, it's obvious. So ultimately what I'm saying is if you break it out, if you put it under a specific unit, and then your code numbers, you're only allowed to code within certain areas. But if we created another department, if you will, appropriations, well, it wouldn't be department, but appropriation division number, then your different units could be assigned to your different operations, and we could keep track of it. I don't know. We have to solve it. What we could do is just have, well, they're
Mr. Chairman, I don't see a problem with structuring it, however, is most clear to the committee, frankly. You know, I'm not sure that we haven't really fully talked this through, but just from my own perspective, I don't see any reason why you couldn't just set it, all medical costs up as a separate division, set up each institution as a unit within that division, and then further break out those individual costs within the units. Medical, dental, whatever, and that give you a chance. I mean, it's going to thicken that budget up some, but as far as providing a clear single place where you could go to in the budget, I mean, that certainly would do it.
I guess part of the I don't remember the decision. I mean, I do remember always wondering what's the cost per institution, and if you take the healthcare cost out, you have a significant disparity, because it may be that the health care being provided at Rollins is not as good as Lusk, and you want to see those trends and see if they're – and we also want to know what our total health care costs are. So I don't – I'm just talking out loud right now, letting people think about it, but if we break it out in these units – my concern is that you don't really see the true cost of medical care for inmates, and I think that's important to see.
Mr. Chairman, I think both ways work, and I think what I understand the agency to be saying as well is that you know, I think you're going to see the same thing that they're trying to tell you now, is that at the different institutions you're going to have different levels of medical expenditures, but a one-time event at any one of those institutions could skew everything. So in that regard, Mr. Chairman, I think if the medical cost component of this thing is important to you and important to the committee, there's certainly no reason why you couldn't show it that way.
I'll just sort of see everybody sort of what the, for me it was important to not only see the, you want to see a component by institution, but you also want to see total. So if we want to do that, then I think the answer is we aggregate them under one series, but then give them a unit number each by institution, so we could see how's everybody. I mean,
Mr. Chairman, can I just clarify a couple of things? One, when you say series, I'm assuming you actually mean a division. In other words, it'll be a separate program. You know, it'll be shown as a separate program. Like,
yeah, it'd be program
11,000. Yeah, okay.
8,001, 8,002, but they'd be aggregated under the program summary.
Right, Mr. Chairman.
I was just going to say, Mr. Chairman, I think that that's a lot more transparent and also more efficient, because as members, I don't see them tracking quarterly reports on the institutions to see what the differences are. So this is a comparison that I think mm-hmm. would be much more visible for
them. So then if you go back to page 8, if we did it that way, for example, would people prefer to do it that way, or okay? So, go ahead.
So, if we are going to find out what the total cost was in any of these institutions, we would have to then go back into that division, pull the unit out for that particular institution, and add that on to that particular unit to get the total cost of that unit.
Right. So you'd have, so if you had it all, for example, on the in a code, let's say it was a 10,000 code, then if you wanted to know what the cost at the the Honor Farm is, you'd have to add the Honor Farm together with the medical cost that would be under another code if you did it that way. Right now, if you look at Wyoming Media or a medical correction institution, or let's just take the state penitentiary, that 6,000 code has the medical cost embedded in it on the front page. This would take that out, so you'd have to add the medical cost back in if you want to see total cost. But I guess my thought is the medical care is so expensive that it ought to be aggregated somewhere, and we ought to be tracking it.
And, Mr. Chairman, just for clarification, I assume that we'll need a report for this biennium and, you know, to finish out this biennium to get you the information you want, and then we would probably include Section 300 language directing how we wanted it budgeted for 15-16.
How difficult would it be just to, let's suppose we use the number 10,000. I don't know if your machine will allow it, maybe, or 8,000. I see that the 8,000s aren't being used. It would be out of sequence. Well, I assume that you only have room for four digits, so you'd have to use 8,000.
Mr. Chairman, ultimately, all four of those digits are available, so you could call it unit 3333.
Oh, okay.
Or not unit, but division 3333.
All
and
right.
Then have,
so,
or whatever
yeah,
you want
so
to call it.
So you could do 9,100, for example. So can we build one just to see what it looks like and see whether it makes sense? How hard would it be to build?
Yeah,
why don't you just try it, see what it looks like. If you can, show us, and then we'll build the 300 if we like it.
Okay. We'll set up the structure, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. My general reaction is that if you only see part of the cost in one area, then you don't have a good feel for the total cost of medicine.
And, Mr. Chairman, we will certainly work with
the
budget office to make that happen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While we're on this health care issue, I remember a report, I think it was last year, with some recommendations that perhaps you could institute. I'm not remembering a lot of the details, maybe perhaps charging some kind of a surcharge. And I was just wondering about your efforts to implement some of those recommendations. And I remember some resistance to some of the recommendations as well, Director. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman and Representative Stewart, we did have that study, as I mentioned, that looked at whether we were providing more services than we needed to be. And the conclusion was that we were actually providing at a higher level than constitutionally required. There were some recommendations such as ways to affect that budget, including charging the inmates co-pays, which would restrict their use of the medical services. It included some recommendations around the contract itself in order to incentivize or incent the vendor to look for efficiencies but share those costs with the state. And I would like to report that we've worked very closely with the medical contractor to contain and even reduce the costs over the past year. Even though medical costs have continued to escalate about 8% per year, you'll see that our budget does not request for any additional medical costs. That's because of the efficiencies that we've been able to identify. During this biennium, we've developed a cost-share scenario that allows us to reduce the total contract cost to offset the medical inflation. This is going to require us to have a reserve of around $2 million or $2.2 million to cover our share of the projected off-site medical costs, but it reduces the contract amount by $4.4 million. So we've worked directly with the vendor to negotiate reduced cost agreements with our providers that provide specialty services and hospitalization in the state in order to reduce those costs. And we've been moderately successful in doing so. Have another meeting at the end of the month with the Cheyenne Regional folks concerning orthopedic care. Currently, Our cost of orthopedic care through the current in-state provider is 368% of Medicaid costs. We can get identical services in Scotts Bluff for 125% of Medicaid costs. So it's three times as expensive in-state, so we're working hard to negotiate better rates. We've been working with Elizabeth Hoy through the governor's office to identify the people to talk to. Frankly, the governor has instructed us to keep those services in-state if at all possible. So we're working hard to negotiate a rate that's more fair, but probably won't be as low as that we can get off out of state, either in the Front Range or Scotts Bluff. So we're working hard on that aspect of the, which was a large part of that recommendation, and we're continuing to work on that. And the results have been mixed. Our orthopedic vendor said that they would give us a 5% reduction, but frankly, that's not enough. So we're looking at other alternatives. We figured out ways and continue to work to identify ways to deliver a constitutional level of health care to our inmates in a way that gives the contract provider an incentive to reduce costs, but also within the contract allows us to share in those reductions. So we're working on an incentive-based contract that would give them an additional incentive if they maintain a level of care that meets not only constitutional standards, but continues to get them certification by both the American Corrections Association and the Correctional NCIC, whatever the name is. It's a certifying
National Correctional Care.
Agency for National Correctional Health Care. So those are things that we're doing within the contract. What we've decided that isn't worth it is to create a copay for the inmates. We feel that it actually restricts the willingness of an inmate to go to seek medical care early when the costs would be situation or the medical problem could be easily and inexpensively addressed, and instead defer them to a point where it would cost us a whole lot more to deliver the services. Any additional questions about the medical care? Mr. Chairman, funding for the 100-bed secure residential substance abuse treatment facility in Casper that we talked quite a bit about is in Unit 1037 on page 47. If you recall the cost breakout in Attachment A, the cost per inmate per day is just over $68 a day. It does provide us with an additional 100 beds of housing and residential treatment capacity and delivers quality best practice treatment that's equivalent to that we're providing in-house. So we'd strongly encourage approval of the standard budget as requested, even though you will hear more about that when we talk about cost reduction strategies. We concur with the $96 reduction contained in the governor's recommendation on page 49 for this cost unit and would ask for your approval of his recommendation. Our priority 2 exception budget request is for sex offender treatment. It appears beginning on page 51 of our budget, and it definitely requires some additional explanation. If you recall, in the 2011-12 budget, the legislature placed $250,000 back into our budget by way of a budget footnote to reinstate what we could of the sex offender assessment and treatment program that had existed in the previous biennium, but that had elapsed due to the loss of continued funding that resulted from our earlier 10% budget reduction decisions back in 2010. Originally, we were to have come back last year with a request for funding to reinstate the sex offender treatment program under the budget footnote, but as you recall, we weren't ready to do so. And this committee authorized us to incorporate such a request in this biennium's budget request instead. We do have a concern that it's not in the public's best interest to release moderate and high-risk sex offenders into our communities without at least some effort to provide them with the opportunity to mitigate their risk of sexual reoffending through treatment prior to release. That concern is heightened due to the lack of sex offender-specific treatment options available within most of our communities. The bulk of the evidence suggests that sex offender-specific treatment can be effective. So we believe that providing treatment is more likely to reduce community risk than doing nothing at all. Therefore, what you see before you is a solution that we believe works for everyone. Approval would allow us to implement a full-scale, best-practice sex offender treatment program incorporating screening, assessment for risk, and amenability to treatment, risk-appropriate treatment, polygraph testing, and community containment model supervision and monitoring upon release. To make this happen, we reassessed our budget and expenditures and concluded that we could identify $2.5 million within our existing budget in general funds that could be repurposed to pay for the sex offender treatment without a request for new money. By in effect net to zeroing general fund money from funding units at Torrington and elsewhere that's currently being expended for substance abuse treatment and replacing those general fund dollars that are being used for drug treatment with tobacco funds that are available within our budget, we can maximize the use of tobacco fund and pay for sex offender treatment using the repurposed general funds without any increases to our budget. As I said, this is our number two priority, and I would respectfully ask the committee to concur with the governor's recommendation on page 52 to approve this repurposing of $2.5 million in general funds for sex offender treatment. Yes, sir.
So I guess why don't you take us through, Bob, and tell us for each of those units what the dollars were for, what they're presently being used for, and what happens to those resources.
Mr. Chairman, Unit 3053 would actually increase tobacco funds. I think I'm reading this right. By $947,700. With no impact on general funds for that. I'd have to go back to 3053, but as I recall, that's, or no, we haven't reached it yet. 3053, as I recall, is the outpatient.
Is that right? At the conservation camp?
Outpatient substance abuse at the conservation camp. Unit 4052 would see a reduction in the tobacco funds. That's tobacco funds that we currently aren't expending, and that's at the Women's Center.
Is that right? Yes.
That's residential substance abuse at the Women's Center, 4052, and so we would reduce that. Our contract didn't come up to that level, so we can use those dollars elsewhere. 4053 is the outpatient substance abuse at the Women's Center, and we would shift some of those residential treatment dollars to cover that increased cost for resident or for non-residential outpatient substance abuse treatment at the Women's Center. 5053 is at the farm, and that's outpatient substance abuse, so that again allows us to use tobacco dollars to provide those services. 6053 for $70,499 is at the penitentiary. Again, that's outpatient. And 9052 is WMCI. That's the residential substance abuse treatment facility at Torrington. So we would reduce the funding, reduce the tobacco funding there to cover those other ones that I've already talked about increasing. And that would also free up general fund dollars of $1.5 million. 9053 is the outpatient at Torrington. Again, that would increase the outpatient tobacco use, tobacco fund usage for outpatient. And 9054 is the transition unit, which, as you may recall, is a shorter-term unit intended for people who are coming back as parole revocations, would provide them with a level of treatment prior to return on probation or parole at the end of that period of treatment. Again, then use tobacco dollars for that, freeing up general fund dollars for a total general fund dollar repurposing of $2.5 million to then use for sex offender treatment.
So let me make sure I understand. So you're adding $2.5 million of general fund into Division 1000, Unit 1038. And then separately, you're also doing the fund switches that you see on page on 147?
Correct, to backfill for the general fund dollars that are shifting to 1038.
Okay, so well taken. That. So the point is you're repurposing, if you will, the $2.5 million. And to make that available, you actually need a total increase from tobacco funds of that are not already in your budget of how much?
No, sir. No increase in tobacco funds. Those tobacco funds are in our budget. We just haven't expended them at the maximum level. So we figured out a way to shift those tobacco funds to cover these general funds that would be repurposed.
So well, in effect, what you're doing is saying, look, we typically have reversions of $2.5 million, so we want to spend those reversions.
Reversions in tobacco dollars, which then go to the trust fund and aren't available for use in the future.
Right. So the no matter how, I mean, ultimately, it is a new program for 2.5, and you're simply reducing other budgets by amounts you generally expect that there will be reversions at those amounts.
Correct.
All right. So then what you're telling us is that with respect to those areas where you're lowering your budgeted areas, that those are areas that have not been using those resources because they typically revert.
They have not been using the tobacco dollars. They've been using general fund dollars. So we had tobacco dollars that would revert. Those tobacco dollars aren't available for expenditure in the future because they go back to the trust account. So therefore, we think it would be smarter for us to use those tobacco dollars and expend them and free up those general fund dollars for the new program that would otherwise cost the state.
Go ahead. I want to make sure I understand this, too, because I'm a little bit confused. Director Lambert, on the first column, increase, decrease tobacco funds. So on 3053, you are actually adding $947,000 worth of tobacco funds to that program. Is that how I'm supposed to read that?
Correct. That's an increase in the tobacco funds in order to maximize the usage of our available tobacco funds.
Okay, because you have this large pot, now you're just reallocating.
Correct.
And then on 4052, though, you're actually removing $830,000 of tobacco funds, which will then come over into this other column?
Well, it doesn't actually go in. Some of it goes into that other column, but that is a repurposing. Our contract for our residential treatment didn't come to the level we expected, so we want to use those dollars to cover the outpatient, which was more expensive than we anticipated.
One second. I'll come back to you. I've got my peak highlighter, okay? We're going to start from 3053, 947,700 tobacco funds.
Correct.
830,346 tobacco funds.
Correct. Reduction.
617 tobacco funds.
Correct.
They're all tobacco funds.
Correct. On the left column, they're all tobacco funds.
Well, I thought where do you get the. So where are your general funds getting? Those are on the next program, the 1.5, 4848, 489?
Correct.
Okay, so.
Mr. Chairman.
You're reorganizing your tobacco funds on the left column. Your right column, you're freeing up the general funds so that ultimately the two accounts are, essentially you're moving it from 452 and 952. And you're redistributing it in order to free up your other funds.
Correct.
Gotcha. Now going back to Senator von Vladeren.
I think I'm following. Is it a true statement that the two columns are unrelated? You're not taking out money out of the left column to make up the right column? Am I understanding that correctly?
They are related. The left column is the movement of the tobacco funds, which then can supplant the general funds in the right column, and those general funds in the right column then become available for sex offender treatment.
Okay, so let me understand this correctly. 9052, you're taking out 1.88 of tobacco funds out of that program, however leftover surplus or just supplanting them with something else. And then those tobacco funds are supporting these other increases in that same column?
Correct.
All right, so you're just shuffling those around. And on the right, the 2.5 million in the bottom total of that right column is basically adding the three above, the three numbers sets above to get that 2.5, and all three of those numbers are general fund numbers?
Correct.
So how are the two columns related, I guess, is where I'm lost.
Mr. Chairman, the way they're related is that the movement of those tobacco dollars in order to meet the needs for treatment, for drug treatment inside the agency, whether that's inpatient or outpatient, results in a net increase in spending of tobacco dollars for those purposes. And those general fund dollars that were previously used to cover those services then becomes available in the right-hand column for sex offender treatment. So by taking tobacco dollars that we're not spending and moving them into or around within those units described in the left column, we're able to free up enough general funds to cover the right column.
Mr. Chairman, if I could follow. So on 5053, to grab that one, it's $540,000. That's tobacco money going into that account. And there was some general fund, there was some general fund money in there that is being supplanted by that tobacco. That's what comes over into the right column?
Well, the general fund dollars that is being pulled out and supplanted by the tobacco funds are in 9052, 9053, and 9054. Correct. That's where the general fund dollars are coming out of.
Is that correct?
Maybe I'm even getting a little more confused.
Let me see if I can explain it. I think I just figured it out. Okay, so you look on your left column, and they've got two accounts. That is the 4052 and the 9052, which they're saying if you can reduce the those, what they're saying is we have an over appropriation of funds in those two accounts that we've not historically not used. Tobacco funds. So reduce those accounts and then beef up those other accounts, which then allows you to move the tobacco, essentially moving general funds into the of 2.5 million. But ultimately, 830 plus 188, those two accounts reductions add up to 2,719,072. The additions add up to 2,719,072, so the tobacco funds are a wash. But by moving them around, they free up the general funds because they're releasing, they're essentially reducing the use of tobacco funds in some and moving it to others.
Mr. Chairman, I believe I understood that somewhat, but what I, 9052, are you taking 1.8 and 1.5 out of that program so you can get your 2.5 at the bottom to put into the sex offender? What is program 9052 that I don't? That's
well,
a lot of money.
What's interesting is when you do this analysis, you're actually increased. You're taking general fund out of different accounts than you're crediting. So,
Mr. Chairman, if I could just briefly the negative numbers in the left column, those are two contracts for residential treatment where the contract amount didn't come to the level that we anticipated. So those are efficiencies that where we wouldn't spend those tobacco dollars. And by shifting those tobacco dollars but out and covering the contract cost for the non-residential plus freeing up the general fund of 2.5, that's the difference. So they are tobacco dollars we're not spending. Most of those tobacco dollars are a result of those two contracts for residential treatment that are cost us less than we anticipated. There is some other tobacco dollars in the budget that we also think that we could maximize spending for non-residential, for outpatient substance abuse treatment, expend the the vast majority, if not all, of our tobacco dollars, and that would result in a savings of general fund dollars. As savings of general fund dollars, we're asking to repurpose to cover the sex offender treatment.
Here's where I'm having, I mean, I can see the math, but you're saying, okay, let's increase tobacco funds for outpatient substance abuse by $900,000, $947,000. And then you're increasing your expenditures in outpatient substance abuse in unit 4053, but ultimately all the losses and revenues are coming, one, from the WMCI substance abuse, that's your 1.5. So you're taking out 1.8, but you're only giving them back 1.5, and then you're taking... Wait a minute. Oh.
they're actually taking out 3.416201 out of unit 9052. The base budget is 5,001,893. That'll give them a governor's recommendation of 1,585,692. Essentially, they're trading residential substance treatment services for outpatient services, reducing the residential substance treatment for outpatient. They're doing one fund switch in the 9054, a partial fund switch in the 9053, but that fund switch is internal with the tobacco funds, and they're freeing up $2.5 million for the sex offenders, and that's in your 9052, 53, and 54. And that's your residential substance abuse treatment, your outpatient substance abuse treatment, and I believe it's a transition unit in 54. So, you know, it's...
I'm glad my card-counting friend can figure it out, because...
Okay, so that's how it works.
I have it. Let's just take a step back and say philosophically, because you're taking... I understand the notion that you got two outpatient contracts that are not being fully utilized. Those funds go back to the tobacco account, and we reappropriate them later. So ultimately, you are increasing expenditures by $2.7
million.
So you're saying if we give you $2.7 million of more tobacco funds, we'll give you $2.5 million for sex offender treatment.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if this will help or not, but just as a matter of clarification, everything, and there's been some vague references to this, but in order to track this summary sheet, everything in the left-hand column was done via the Chapter 17 out of existing authority. And everything on the right-hand you'll see reflected in these various units in the exception request column. And so with respect to the...
You can't take Chapter 17 and move those funds around unless you do the... Did you do a B-11 for those already?
No, they use the net-to-zero process in the Chapter 17 to move the tobacco funds around, but not to request the general funds. The general funds, that's why they are shown specifically as exception requests.
Are you telling me that the left column's already been done?
Yes, it's reflected in the standard budget.
All right. So last year we appropriated $830,000 more in unit 4052, and this year you're spending more money in 3053. I didn't think that the Chapter 11 process was available to move. I mean, ultimately, let me put it this way: let's go to 1052. If we put another $1.8 million of tobacco funding in there, it was for a program. And now you're using the Chapter 17 just to sweep it out of there and move it around to other programs without going through the budget process?
All of these movements, I believe I'm correct in saying, all of these movements are to the residential substance treatment units throughout the overall budget. So,
well, I mean, we should, if a this is the same conversation we had last week. If there's a B-11 process and they come in and they say, look, we want to move these funds around, the governor says, fine, and he signs it, I suppose you can do that. But then we get a report on the B-11, and we can say, wait a minute. I mean, if some legislator or some person at one time put more money into one program than the other, and now you're shifting around and saying we don't like your programs, we want to repopulate our own programs.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is these programs all provide the same service, but that there's an overallocation of these funds in the context of WMCI.
Mr. Chairman, this is the same, was part of the same discussion for medical when we moved the substance abuse funding to the institution level. We moved it at a level that we predicted we would use it, and we found that we didn't, that we the services at one institution aren't what we projected, so like the medical and the B-11 process to adjust that, this is a request to adjust the substance abuse funding to be reflective of actual costs, maximizing tobacco dollars and freeing up general fund.
If I'm a legislature and I come in and say, you know, you guys, we need to do more substance abuse at Torrington, and here's my plan, and here's an and I get another $100,000 put into that program. It's not my expectation that you'll spend $5,000 and say, hey, we're not spending $95,000 and we're going to move it to another program. Thank you very much. Well, I'll tell you what. I want to think about this some more. Let's take a lunch break, come back at 1. We'll talk to our staff. You guys talk to each other. But I'm having a hard problem accepting the notion that you can make these movements in a Chapter 7 with 17 process without a B-11 and without coming through us. So we'll talk to our staff, you guys talk to each other, and we'll hash it out again after lunch. See you at 1:00.